Hello, everyone. My name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to share items from Time Magazine with you. I need to remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. We're going to read today from the December 8th issue of Time Magazine. And we're going to start with an article from the brief section on page 10. Headline, good question. What would 50-year mortgages mean for buyers? This was written by Chantel Lee. The Trump administration has begun promoting the idea of 50-year mortgages as a way to make homes more affordable for buyers, a plan that has drawn criticism even from some of the president's allies, and that experts warn could come with potentially major drawbacks. Introduced soon after Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Bill Pulte wrote in a post on X, quote, thanks to President Trump, we are indeed working on the 50-year mortgage, a complete game changer, unquote. The longer-term mortgage would mark a significant extension on the most common type of home loan in the United States, a 30-year fixed mortgage, which borrowers repay over three decades. Several right-wing commentators and lawmakers were quick to voice opposition to the idea, which Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene said in a post on X, would ultimately reward the banks, mortgage lenders, and home builders while people pay far more in interest over time and die before they ever pay off their home. The Trump administration proposal also generated criticism from housing experts who say that the benefits to home buyers would be minimal. The obvious reason to talk about a 50-year mortgage is that the monthly payments would be lower than those for a 30-year mortgage, according to Alex Schwartz, professor of urban policy at the New School, who walked Time Magazine through the pros and cons. Imagine, for instance, that a person is purchasing a $500,000 home with a 30-year mortgage. The current average interest rate for a 30-year fixed mortgage is about 6.2%, according to Freddie Mac. That means if the home buyer made a down payment of 20%, their monthly payment of the loan's principal and interest combined would be $2,455, according to Fannie Mae's mortgage calculator. But if the buyer took out a 50-year mortgage, again, with a down payment of 20%, then their monthly payment of principal and interest, assuming that the interest rate stays the same, would be $2,171, according to Fannie Mae. That is a little under $300 less per month than for a 30-year mortgage. It is a reduction, but it's certainly not dramatic, said Schwartz, of the difference between monthly payments. He also noted that in practice, the interest rate for a 50-year mortgage likely would not be the same as that for a 30-year mortgage, which could reduce the potential savings. A higher interest rate is just one of a few possible drawbacks to a 50-year mortgage, he says. Another is that buyers would be in debt far longer. If you were 30 years old and bought a home with a 30-year mortgage, it would be owned free and clear at age 60, so you'd only have to pay property taxes and maintenance on the house, no longer having to pay a mortgage during your older years or retirement, Schwartz says. If you were now paying a loan for a 50-year mortgage and you're 30, the mortgage wouldn't end until you're age 80. So you would have a period of time, most likely during retirement, where you have to pay the debt service cost on top of the property taxes and maintenance. The other issue, Schwartz says, is that homeowners would not build equity as quickly with a 50-year mortgage as they would with a 30-year mortgage. For the first several years of a mortgage, a homeowner is primarily paying interest. It takes several years before they actually start reducing their debt. Buyers with 50-year mortgages would be paying down their debt much more slowly compared with those with 30-year mortgages. And if housing prices go down during that time, people with 50-year mortgages may be more likely to be left in negative equity, which means they would owe more than their house is now worth. These are major trade-offs here, Schwartz said. Amid all the criticisms, the president has defended the idea. All a 50-year mortgage would mean is you pay less per month and over a longer period of time, Trump told Fox News in an interview that aired on November 10th. That might help a little bit, he said. All right, let's go to page 11. Nope, nothing there. Let's move over to the health section of the brief. And let's look at five migraine symptoms that aren't headaches. And this is written by Angela Haupt, H-A-U-P-T. Nearly 40 million people in the United States suffer from migraine headaches, making the painful disorder one of the most common that neurologists treat. It's also among the most confusing. Because of the many ways it can show up, it can take more than a decade to receive an accurate diagnosis. The general concept about migraines in the common population is that it's a headachey syndrome, says Dr. Hamid Hamdi, a neurologist who leads the headache clinic at UT Health Houston Neurosciences in Sugarland, Texas. And certainly, many migraine sufferers, though not all, experience a throbbing headache. Beyond that, however, people don't know about all the other symptoms that migraines can cause. So they are very surprised in the beginning, he says. Even as neurologists, we don't always attribute those symptoms to migraine until we have ruled out other things like a stroke. We asked Hamdi and other neurologists which non-headache migraine symptoms they see the most often. And there are five of them. Number one, food cravings. A couple of days before developing a headache, people typically enter the prodrome early phase of a migraine. Surprisingly, many report food cravings, especially for salty foods, sweets, and chocolate. The way that scientists think about this kind of craving has evolved. While some once believed that foods like chocolate caused migraines, research suggests that is not the case, and there's no reason for people to avoid them. Generally, it was believed that chocolate could trigger migraines, Handy said. But what we believe now is that it's not chocolate that triggers it. It's that people were having a craving for chocolate as a prodrome of migraine. Symptom number two. Vision changes. About 20% of people with migraines experience a visual aura or temporary changes in vision. These can show up as shimmering spots, zigzag lines, blind spots, tunnel vision, or even temporary blindness. Visual aura is likely caused by a wave of electrical and chemical activity that spreads across the brain. People have described it all different ways, says Dr. Thomas Bravo, a neurologist and director of the Headache Center at Loma Linda University Health in California. It can be disturbing to a patient if it's the first time, but once they know it's linked to their migraines and will pass within an hour, it's not quite so scary. Symptom number three, sensory sensitivity. Migraines are often accompanied by increased sensitivity to light, sound, and smells. The scents you are exposed to every day may strike you as much stronger and more putrid than usual, for example, and can be anywhere from unpleasant to actually painful, depending on the person, Bravo says. You also might find that you can't stand even the slightest, gentlest touch. Some people experience tactical allodynia, which happens when the central nervous system becomes extra sensitive to things that touch your skin. Symptom number four, motor changes. Hemiplegic migraines, which are rare but serious, are associated with motor changes, like one-sided body weakness, or even paralysis. This type of migraine has a strong genetic component and is often passed down from a parent. Basically, your face, arm, and leg get weak during the migraine attack, and then it goes away afterwards, says Dr. Brian Gerhardston, a neurologist and director of headache medicine at JFK Neuroscience Institute in New Jersey. It can look exactly like a stroke. So a lot of these patients do end up in the emergency room. Seeking urgent care is a good idea. The doctor adds, since it's important to rule out potentially life-threatening conditions. And number five, the last symptoms, abdominal pain. An abdominal migraine can cause a terrible stomach ache, nausea, vomiting, and a lack of appetite. People vomit over and over and over. Gerhardston says, while there are different theories for why this happens, research suggests that it's likely related to changes in the gut-brain axis. These gastrointestinal symptoms are common among kids and can be hard to diagnose, especially if young patients don't have a headache or are unable to articulate that they do. I see pediatric doctors scratching their heads trying to figure out what exactly is going on, Gerhardston says. When they've ruled out all the more organic causes, they come to migraine as the final diagnosis. All right, let's move on to the risk report from the View section. Headline, The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. He is a contributing editor. 3 years and 9 months after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the war grinds on. There's been plenty of news and noise of late. Yet, as we approach the end of 2025, there's no sign of resolution on the horizon. In recent months, the Europeans have done much more to bolster Ukraine's defense and its economy. In fact, this has gone from a war in which the U.S. provided most of the direct support to Ukraine to one where the Europeans are today taking the leadership mantle. But despite skepticism on both sides of the Atlantic that Donald Trump would do much to help Ukraine, Washington too is escalating against Russia. Trump has grown tired of waiting for Vladimir Putin to offer any significant concessions, And his administration is not only continuing to share intelligence with Kiev, but is also now permitting Ukraine to use its weapons against targets deeper inside Russia. Successful strikes on energy infrastructure have reduced how much refined product Russia can get to market. Its energy exports are down nearly a quarter from the start of this year. The Trump team has also imposed new sanctions on Russian energy giants Lukoil and Rosneft, though these will take time to have a major economic impact. It's imposing concerted pressure on India, one of Russia's major remaining energy customers, to cut back on its imports. India appears to be complying. This pressure will cost Russia and its war machine billions, maybe tens of billions of dollars in years to come. A shortage of manpower means that Ukraine can't launch a satisfied counteroffensive to retake lost ground. But Ukraine's access to accurate long-range missiles and the lack of any apparent Trump administration's prohibitions on using them against targets deep inside Russia have created a major headache for Moscow. Russia's largest warm water ports, hundreds of miles from the war's front lines, are now within range. That matters, because these are Russia's only crude oil export terminals that don't freeze in the winter, and the ability of Russian air defenses to protect them remains unproven. Yet there's no sign Putin will soon waver in his determination to return Ukraine to Moscow's orbit. And Russia has proved that it's willing and able to take punches from the West. We shouldn't expect that sanctions, a Ukrainian counteroffensive, European resolve, or Trump's impatience with Putin will force Russia to limit the intensity of its attacks in 2026. It's also clear that across Ukraine, that Russia will make this another cold winter. By using more drones and missiles to overwhelm Ukraine's under-replenished air defenses in order to strike its already damaged power generation capacity. That's a blow for both the country's economy and the morale of its people. Ukrainians are already losing some of their will to fight. In a July Gallup poll, 69% of Ukrainians said they wanted a negotiated end to the war as soon as possible, against 24% who supported a fight to total victory. That's a near complete reversal from the Gallup results from 1922 and 23. Unfortunately, a negotiated settlement won't happen soon. Putin continues to demand that Kiev concede even more territory than Russia now holds, and that Ukraine effectively disarm itself. Both, he surely knows, are non-starters for Volodymyr Zelensky's government. Whatever Trump does in the coming months, European leaders expect a continued fight, and it's becoming more likely that European governments will use up to 140 billion euros in frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine over the next 2 years. That is enough to keep Kiev in the war. The Russians will make more modest advances on the ground. Ukrainian civilians will continue to pay a heavy price. Many more Ukrainians, and especially Russian soldiers, will be killed. And Moscow will continue to provide NATO countries with espionage, sabotage, drone incursions, cyber attacks, and whatever else it believes it can get away without starting a wider war that the Russians could not win. All right, and we continue now with an essay in the View section. Headline: the real reason we fail to feed those in need. And this was written by David Beasley, who is the former executive director of the United Nations World Food Program. Food is the difference between life and death. Everyone knows this, but it's also the difference between stability and instability, union and division, and peace and war. I have had a front row seat to some of the worst recent humanitarian crises, from Yemen and Syria to Afghanistan and Gaza. And this has been true time and time again. I have sat face to face with mothers who have told me, my son didn't want to join ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but he had to feed his little daughter. These are families who don't want to leave home, but will do whatever any father or mother would do to feed their children, even if it means risking everything. The power of food is simple to understand, yet the symptoms around it are anything but simple. When famine strikes, we rightfully react. Emergency aid is activated. Millions of dollars are deployed. But repeatedly, the cycle starts afresh. We fail because we treat famine in isolation from its interconnected crises. We have enough funds and enough food to feed the world. The real reason humanitarian efforts keep failing is because decision makers profit from short-term solutions at the cost of addressing the root causes of inequality and food insecurity. When the World Food Program received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2020, it was honored in a year marked by severe global conflicts and crises, including the pandemic. In announcing its decision, the Nobel community hailed the scale of aid that had been provided the previous year. With our team having helped close to 100 million people across 88 countries. But it explicitly cited the wider impact of our approach in shifting perceptions of famine and hunger, moving from treating crisis as disaster in need of immediate relief to understanding access to food as a powerful tool in both conflict prevention and resolution. Whether in the form of vegetables, rice, or bread, our team was providing the weapons of peace required to start reconciliation within communities that create stability, instability, and create stability across nations. The reason food is effective at establishing peace is the same reason leaders use food as a weapon of control to weaken majorities or deplete autonomy, because food is powerful. But food's strength comes from hunger being more powerful. Hunger drives humanity to all kinds of extremes and the worst kinds of horror. Food shortages brought on by one war can trigger conflict on the other side of the planet. Every day we see traumatic images of people risking their lives for the chance of a better one, whether that's in Gaza, Sudan, or Yemen. Most of us cannot imagine the extremities that would drive them to do so. But the truth is, they are often risking everything to feed themselves and their families. These are people entering direct conflict zones for the chance of obtaining a single sack of flour. Today, we have unprecedented amounts of global wealth and technological capability. Despite catastrophic USAID cuts, the past few years have seen organizations raise record-breaking funds to combat global hunger. In many respects, you could say we have succeeded in our humanitarian efforts. Just 200 years ago, approximately 80% of people lived in extreme poverty. Today, that number is below 10%. Last year, the WFP delivered over 16 billion rations to people suffering from starvation. We have built global systems capable of lifting billions out of hardship. But tell that to the 10% who go to bed hungry every night, the 800 million people we continue to feed. The 800 million people we continue to fail. Despite extreme ordinary progress, global food security is getting worse. Enduring conflicts, coupled with unrelenting climate shocks, means that any organization may never achieve their ultimate purpose of making themselves obsolete. This is not a result of insufficient supply. We produce more food per person than at any point in human history. Our failure is man-made, created by a lack of access, understanding, and political will. From my years leading the World Food Program, I have witnessed some of the most devastating humanitarian crises of our time and seen first-rate how much more effective it is to address root causes than provide short-term relief. Take the impact of the Russian-Ukraine conflict, which severely affected nations around the globe because of the sharp increase in the costs of food and fertilizer. Nations like Niger were particularly vulnerable, with many people living in urban areas, limited access to arable land and water becomes a major driver of food insecurity. In addition to responding to the immediate effect of famine, the World Food Program work has prioritized emergency preparedness with an emphasis on ecological restoration to help protect climate-sensitive livelihoods and support smallholder farmers. This meant that while the shocks were certainly felt, 80% of the villages were supported through resilience programs, required no aid because of the war in Europe. That alone amounted to food people protected because of a strategy that treated food access as more than a symptom of conflict or pronounced change. There is no doubt that reaching those who need immediate relief is of the highest importance, but it is not a long-term solution. If we simply continue to distribute food, we will be doing that for the next 1,000 years. Whereas when we implement resilience programs, build water wells, and rehabilitate land, the amount of aid needed drops significantly and for the long term. This investment in food systems sustainable infrastructure and agriculture is not only a moral imperative, but also an economic one. Support for displaced people at the U.S. border costs thousands of dollars per week for each child, but it takes just $1 to $2 a week to fund resilience programs across Latin America that enable families to grow their own food. Similarly, the costs of supporting refugees who come to Germany, which took in over 1 million people over the course of this Syrian refugee crisis, came to an estimated 30 billion euros in 2023. From my work with the World Food Program, I learned that support for a Syrian in Syria costs just 50 cents a day. In short, when people don't have food, they move to find it. And when people move, the cost is 1,000 times more. In order to achieve the political willpower necessary to stop this cycle, we must lay out the consequences of not finding strategic international aid. Food insecurity drives migration, fuels conflict, and erodes democracy. That's how you get through to lawmakers and taxpayers. But too often, even our best efforts are hampered by bureaucracy. When good people are trapped in rigid systems, long-term strategies are sidelined, and technical jargon clouds both the mission and key personnel's understanding of it. This issue is exemplified at events like COP30. It's a gathering where food fuel lobbyists drown out the voices of climate vulnerability nations, where the promises made are routinely broken, and where substantive action is sacrificed for the appearance of progress. That's why much of my work now is focused on the young people who will soon be at the wheel. Young people who are distraught and disenchanted by national and international institutions that have left so many down. My message to them is to be careful and stay hopeful. Don't tear down the systems that are teaching the 90%. Fix them. Integrate your modern tools and use technology, connectivity, and data to clearly evidence those where proven framework can be made stronger. Because hunger is not just a failure of morality, it's a failure of understanding and communication. Breaking bread is not just charity, it's strategy, and it is our pathway to peace. And I think we are going to end our coverage of this issue at this point because the next article is like 6 pages long. So we will stop there for today with our coverage of the December 8th, 2025 issue of Time Magazine. Again, I need to remind you, you have been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, I'm Nancy Porter, and it's my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you.